From Hologram Radio, this is Covered, a conversation about books with the people who write them. I'm your host, Harry Marks, and today's guest is a World Fantasy Award-winning author of the short story collections In the Forest of Forgetting and Interfictions, and she's been a finalist for the Nebula, Locus, Crawford, Seyun, and Mythopoeic Awards. She teaches literature and writing at Boston University, as well as in the Stone Coast MFA program. The Strange Case of the Alchemist's Daughter, out now from Saga Press. Theodora Goss, welcome to Covered.
Hi, Harry. How are you?
I am fantastic. So just to break the ice and kick everything off, The Strange Case of the Alchemist's Daughter is a very unique novel in the way it's told, but also in the way you collect different characters and stories from Victorian and Gothic literature. Would you mind just giving a brief, you know, couple of sentence introduction about the book?
Okay. So The Strange Case of the Alchemist's Daughter is about five young women, unusual young women. Their names are Mary Jekyll, Diana Hyde, Catherine Moreau, Beatrice Rappaccini, and Justine Frankenstein. And obviously, most readers are going to recognize at least some of those names, who are living in late 19th century London. The book starts with Mary, who doesn't yet know that the other young women are out there. And she slowly discovers things about her father, the late Dr. Jekyll, the sorts of experiments he was conducting. And she comes to find out that these other women are out there and that they also were formed by, I would say, mad scientists. They were formed through experimentation. The first one she discovers is Diana Hyde, who claims to be her sister, and she has to figure out what that's about. And then she starts to discover that the other women are out there and that their lives are linked in interesting ways because they all had, in a sense, mad scientist fathers, and their mad scientist fathers knew each other.
Right. And as you mentioned, the story is told from the point of view of Mary, but anyone who reads the book is going to notice right away something. It's like the elephant in the room with this book is that it's told from Mary's point of view, but it's written as a manuscript by Catherine with comments interspersed throughout from the characters reading the manuscript, which I thought was fantastic. And I'm wondering, where did that idea come from?
I'm glad you liked it. I was worried that people would think it was annoying. And I think some people do find it a little annoying, at least at first, which I totally understand. So, yes, it's told mostly from the point of view of Mary. There are places where the point of view switches. Mm-hmm. And I think I drove my editor a little bit crazy with that. Certainly the copy editor was going, "What is this writer doing?" So here's where it all started. I was doing a PhD in English literature, and my field is the Victorian era, specifically the late Victorian era. And my PhD dissertation was on monsters in the late Victorian era. So I was writing about Dracula. I was writing about Island of Dr. Moreau, Picture of Dorian Gray, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, all of these amazing late 19th century texts about monsters. And the basic question I was trying to answer was, how come all of these texts, including Carmilla, which is one of the great vampire stories, and a bunch of others that nobody's ever heard of unless they've studied Victorian literature, the question was, how come so many of these texts come out between 1870 and 1910? What was different about that era? And I had an answer to that that was quite technical. It had to do with the rise of anthropology as a discipline. But what I noticed as I was doing this work for my dissertation was that this was a great era of mad scientists. There are a lot of mad scientists running around. And the funny thing is that they have a tendency to either create or almost create female monsters. The most famous monsters are the male ones, right? We've got Dr. Jekyll, we've got Dracula, for example, Dorian Gray. So the famous monsters, the ones we remember, the ones I mostly wrote about, are male, but you find these really interesting female monsters as well. So this was outside my era because it's much earlier in the century, but in Frankenstein, you have Victor Frankenstein creating his male monster, and the male monster says, "Make me a female because I'm alone. I want a woman in my life." And he starts to, he gets the body parts and he goes off to this island, which is, in the north of England. And he sits there in this little hut. He starts to assemble this monster. And then he thinks, oh my gosh, my male monster and my female monster could mate and I can't have that. And he actually takes the monster apart, the female monster, bit by bit, takes her body parts. And he doesn't want anyone to notice that he has, you know, random female body parts lying around. So he throws them in the ocean. Mm-hmm. And I read that scene. I was like, man, what's going on there? Like there's some power to this scene. And then we've got Dr. Moreau, and Dr. Moreau, the entire time that the novel's going on, is trying to create a woman out of a puma. And then you've got Dr. Rappaccini kind of in the middle of the century in the story by Nathaniel Hawthorne. And he's got a daughter and he's made her poisonous so that she can take care of his poisonous plants. And that's in a short story called Rappaccini's Daughter. And so I thought, you know, what's going on here? There's this constant theme of female monsters. There are a bunch of them clustered at the end of the century. And I thought somebody's got to write about these women, particularly because in the stories, they all die. They're all killed off. They're too dangerous to exist. And they don't get to say very much. They don't get to tell their own stories. It's not like Frankenstein's monster. I mean, Frankenstein's monster gets a big portion of the book and he gets to actually tell his story. The female monsters never get to tell their stories. And I thought, you know what? That doesn't sound right to me. I want to tell their stories. So it's like it all came out of this doctoral dissertation where I was doing this very official research. But then I thought there are these stories here. And when I started trying to write this book, it wasn't coming together. I was trying to write it in a very conventional way. And I thought, what's wrong? Why doesn't it feel like it's coming alive to me? And it seemed to me that the most important thing about the book were the voices, in fact, that you just needed to hear the characters talking. And so there are voices all over the place, I think. I mean, that was at least the goal, that the characters are writing their story, but they're also talking over each other because these are five young women living together. What would that be like, right? They would be contradicting each other. Sometimes they would be fighting. They would be disagreeing because that's what it's like when five very different young women live together.
Right. It's like the Victorian facts of life.
It kind of, I have never heard it that way. Maybe that should have been a cover blurb. I mean, I was definitely influenced by a whole bunch of different things. And one of them was, you know, the Nancy Drew stories where you have Nancy and her friends, George and Bess. These stories we get of girls living together and doing things together, which is a genre. I actually haven't talked about that as an influence before, but it was definitely an influence. And I wanted to do that because I felt like we didn't have enough stories where women were talking to each other. And so these women talk to each other like crazy. They talk over each other. They, right. You know, are continually conversing. The other influence that went into structuring the book this way is that this is a book about monsters. And if you look at any of those texts, Jekyll and Hyde, Frankenstein, etc., they are not just about monsters, they are stylistically monstrous. Dracula is probably the best example in that the entire text is made up of other texts. It's recordings, newspaper clippings, diary entries, all of these things put together. And so the text itself is like a Frankenstein's monster. It's stitched together out of these different accounts, and you never get a reliable voice. You don't get reliable voices in any of these texts. And so that's what I'm doing.
And I wanted to talk about the monster aspect, because in one of the exchanges between the women, they wonder if anyone will read or care about their exploits. And Beatrice Rappaccini says, there is always interest in monsters. And these characters and stories are told and retold and reimagined. And I'm wondering, why do we keep coming back to these characters? We see it in The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. We see it in Penny Dreadful. We see it in, you know, in numerous film and television retellings. You know, probably the most famous are, you know, Frankenstein, Boris Karloff, and Bela Lugosi as Dracula. Why do we keep coming back to these?
Well, I think a couple reasons. We keep going back to this era first, And I think it's because this is the birth of the modern. This is when the era we live in was born. I mean, if you think about it, this is when people were sending telegraphs for the first time all over the world. And the kind of instantaneous communication that we have was born in this era. This is when trains were stitching together all of Europe. So you could travel very quickly to different places in Europe, which actually I ended up exploring somewhat in my second book in this series. So you have travel much faster than people had ever had it before. The motor car is about to come. The telephone is about to come. You have electrification. You have advances in medicine. All of the things that create the world we actually live in start right now, or you know, right in the books now, basically,
right.
Which is the 1890s. And so
it's also a very monstrous time. If you think of it,
yes.
It's really like the birth of the serial killer, H.H. Holmes, Jack the Ripper. You've got these men who are pushing the envelope when it comes to murder. And so there's a lot of, you get stories like Sweeney Todd and turning people into meat pies. And, you know, that comes out of this as well, I think.
Yes. And it's not just that you have people killing other people, because, I mean, serial killers, people who kill people have been with us forever. But the serial killer is not just someone who kills a lot of people. It's a media construct, right? And so right around this era, you had this proliferation of print media, especially in London, but you had books and newspapers going all over the world, and you had news stories being transmitted by telegraph, and the media construction of the serial killer. So the serial killer as an idea really comes from this era. So yeah, absolutely. You had the birth of the Metropolitan Police Force, the idea of the detective. All of those things. So the era is part of it. The other thing is monsters. I actually teach a last spring, for the first time, I taught a class on monsters, even though I've been teaching these texts for a long time. But we really focused in on the monstrous. And the monstrous shows us the limits of the human. So we define ourselves as against the monstrous. And so I think we're absolutely perennially fascinated with monsters. I think that fascination's very old.
Right. And I've always been fascinated. I just finished watching the Netflix series Mindhunter about the birth of the serial killer as in the nomenclature, and, you know, profiling serial killers and what makes them tick. And I think there's people just have a fascination with what makes the human brain go haywire in a way that forces them or causes them to take another life as if they were pulling a weed out of the ground.
Yeah, because at some level, I think we're all worried about ourselves, right? Like, what are the limits of my capabilities? Where could I go wrong? What could I do? I mean, I think back to Agatha Christie murder mysteries, where Hercule Poirot says, everyone is capable of murder under the right circumstances. We're fascinated by what we think of as aberrations, because ultimately we know that these capabilities are in all of us, right? It's like, I'm exploring the dark side. How much of that darkness is in me?
Right. Not to get too colloquial about it, but there's a graphic novel, Batman the Killing Joke, and it tells the origin story of the Joker, and he says in it that you're basically one bad day away. He says to Batman, you're basically one bad day away from becoming me, because that's all it took for me to be this way. It was just one bad day that something happened. So yeah, I mean, we're all wondering, you know, do I have this in me, and am I one bad day away from becoming Jack the Ripper or the Joker or whoever?
Yeah. One of the things I learned actually from my dissertation director, who's a professor named Jean-Paul Riquelme, who specializes in modernity, the Gothic, all sorts of fascinating things, was that Batman is the superhero version of Dracula.
Really? Because I've always heard him as the superhero version of Sherlock Holmes.
That's interesting. So you have Sherlock Holmes and Dracula. I mean, you can see how Batman would be the superhero version of Dracula, but
right.
you can, it's interesting to think about him as sort of halfway between those two things. There's a sense in which Dracula and Sherlock Holmes are sort of the flip sides of each other. Although actually I would probably say that even more about Dr. Jekyll. And one of the places my book came from, the original idea came from, was looking at a map that's in the front of the Norton edition of Jekyll and Hyde. And it shows Regent's Park. Mm-hmm. And it's there because it shows the places, the locations that Jekyll and Hyde happened, that the strange case of Dr. Jekyll and Hyde, that the action is takes place, because it's all mm-hmm. located around Regent's Park. And right on the other side of Regent's Park is Baker Street. And so I thought, okay, if Jekyll and Hyde were real, Sherlock Holmes would have heard of the murder of Sir Danvers Carew. And that was one of the first places where my mind went, oh, all right. So in 1890, Mary could have walked across the park and consulted Sherlock Holmes, and it would have taken her. And I made that walk. I research all of these places. So I went to Regent's Park and I walked up and down Baker Street. I went to the Sherlock Holmes Museum. It takes mm-hmm. 20 minutes tops.
Today's episode is brought to you by Nocht Sound Engineering. Nocht helps you record, edit, and produce great podcasts, streamlining the process so you can deliver high-quality shows to your audience. Whether you just need to trim the ums and you knows, or you're looking to set up the perfect recording rig, Nocht has it all covered. Speaking of, Nocht makes every episode of this podcast sound terrific. Consider this more than just an advertisement, consider it an endorsement. So if you're looking to bring your podcast to the next level, contact Nocht Sound Engineering today at nochtsound.com. That's nachtsound.com. Nocht, more than a stack of tracks. And when you were working on this and you had come up with this idea, you know, like I said, we have League of Extraordinary Gentlemen and Penny Dreadful. We have all this territory that's been tread over and over again. Were you worried that even though you're writing it from the point of view of these daughters, some of whom are made up, were you ever worried that you were sort of saying to yourself, well, do I really need to go over this again? We already know these stories.
Except we don't, because, and I love those. I love League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. I love what I watched of Penny Dreadful. I actually watched a little bit of it when I started writing this stuff, and I consciously turned it off. So someday I will go back and watch it. Mm-hmm. I watched maybe two episodes and I thought, you know what? I don't want to be influenced by that. But League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, it's all guys. I mean, there's Mina Murray in there. And actually, you know, to be honest, Mina Murray there is fairly sexualized. And it's just her among all of these men, at least in the ones I read, which were the earliest ones. And so I suppose at one level you could say I'm treading territory that has been tread before. I'm not so worried about that because I think it's wonderful territory. Mm-hmm. And I think it opens itself up to so many different rewritings and reinterpretations. But the other thing I saw was that nobody else was dealing with it the way I wanted to deal with it. I mean, I had spent so much time as a PhD student with these characters, and there were other ones like Helen Raymond in The Great God Pan that probably a lot of people haven't even heard of, really obscure ones.
Yeah, that was new to me too.
Yeah. And so I thought, nobody has told the stories of these characters. And I was writing partly out of a sense of urgency that they had stories and I wanted to tell their stories. They had things to say. There's a way in which in literature of this era specifically, women's voices get erased. You can see it in something like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, where the story really is about the English gentleman. It's about men. And so almost all the characters are men. interestingly enough, as soon as you get to any kind of theatrical production, you have women added. So I'm not, certainly not the first one to do that. But the women who are added are usually a fiancé and a prostitute. And they have nothing to say to each other, really. They're there for other purposes. But I guess it was a sense that there were these characters there, and I wanted to say things for them, have them say things through me, and they hadn't spoken before.
Right. And that's what I really liked about the book, is that you do have this vantage point of, you're telling the stories of these women as told by these women, because the history in these Victorian and Gothic novels are always told by the men, and you're putting them in a situation where they are now going outside of the social and cultural norms and mores of Victorian London. But in saying that, I did want to talk to you about the difficulties in doing that. I don't know if you had read, there was an article back in May where Hilary Mantel had written about the difficulties with writing women in historical fiction. And even though the characters in this are fictional, they do exist in a real time period.
Right.
And she had said, this is a persistent difficulty for women writers who want to write about women in the past, but can't resist retrospectively empowering them. A good novelist will have her characters operate within the ethical framework of their day, even if it shocks her readers. Now, I never found that these women were behaving in such a way in public that was unbecoming of a lady at the time, but they certainly are going on these adventures that, you know, even the men in the book are saying, well, you really shouldn't be here. This isn't fit for a young lady. And, you know, this is basically men's work and you should go back home. What was it like writing that story? And from those points of view, remaining faithful to the time period, but at the same time, writing an exciting story about these five women who, you know, are going on these adventures.
Well, I had a much easier time than Mantel because she's writing further in the past. I'm writing the late 1800s. And in the late 1800s, you actually have, I guess we now call it first wave feminism. It wasn't really first wave because, you know, you had Mary Wollstonecraft talking about women's rights much earlier. But you had, this is the era of the suffrage movement. This is the era of the new woman. And so what I wrote, what you have in the book, is competing narratives. So you have Mrs. Poole, the housekeeper, and she's saying what you're doing is not proper for a young lady, but she really mm-hmm. belongs to an earlier generation as well. And then you right. have Mary, who's saying, oh, I was brought up to be a lady. I'm uncomfortable doing some of these things, but I still want to go out and be adventurous. So how do I balance that? Then you have Catherine, who was a Puma on the island of Dr. Moreau, and really came to England in the not distant past. And so she was not brought up to be a lady at all. So she's, and I don't want to give too much away, but she has a completely different perspective. You actually have Diana doing a lot of inappropriate things in public mm-hmm. because Diana's the daughter of Mr. Hyde. And so she's going to be breaking all sorts of social rules. You have Beatrice Rappaccini, who is very ladylike, instinctively, simply because of who she is. And part of this is their personalities too. They all have very different, at least in my head, hopefully in the book, they all have very different personalities. And then you have Justine Frankenstein, and Justine also belongs to an earlier generation. And she is very religious. She's very pious. She's very gentle. She's gone through a lot of trauma. So she has a different attitude. So they all have different perspectives, really, on what it means to be a woman, also what it means to be a lady in this time period. And you do have people responding to them in different ways. So my Holmes and Watson, I think, I mean, there are people out there who are huge Holmes and Watson fans. I'm actually a huge Holmes and Watson fan. I've read every single one of those stories. And I reread them in preparation for writing this. I tried to be true to my idea of who Holmes and Watson are. Hopefully they're, you know, people aren't too bothered by the fact that I've rewritten these very, very popular characters. But they, each of them has a slightly different attitude. And you see that in the original books. Sherlock Holmes is an iconoclast in a lot of ways. I mean, he is for enterprising young women. He, mm-hmm. he speaks very kindly of enterprising young women. And then you've got Watson, who's a little bit more traditional. Right. I mean, and Holmes loves Irene Adler, right? And Irene Adler is walking around London in men's clothes, and Holmes thinks this is, she's the woman.
Right. And what I like about Holmes is that it's not about what is culturally appropriate. It's always, what can you do for me? If you're essential to the case, if you're useful to me, then I will keep you in the circle. But if you're not, then I don't want anything to do with you, man or woman.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I think Mary says at one point something like, you know, she's worried about the parlor rug. She's worried about the house, and they have different attitudes towards a bunch of different things, decorating, food. And she basically says, you know, the parlor rug is shabby. He's not going to notice it anyway, unless there's a corpse on it.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, you know, that's another thing I wanted to bring in, that these are women on adventures, and there are practical issues that come into play. One of the things that bothers me often in adventure stories is that everyone's off on an adventure, they're having these great fights, and there are things that aren't included. Like, for example, if you have a character shooting a gun, and that character is shooting a gun for the first time, they're going to be startled by the kickback. And it's going to hurt. It's going to hurt your arm. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to get up in the morning and get dressed. You have to eat lunch. You have to find a place to go to the bathroom. Like, all right. of these things happen in normal life. So I also wanted to make sure that even though I was writing about, you know, adventures, that this was also very real. So I tried to bring in this almost kind of Victorian realism to the extent that I could.
Right. There's a lot of talk of, well, I should have eaten before we did this. And I thought that was refreshing, that these are human beings who are, you know, they're not just on the chase, they're not just on the hunt for this society, but they actually are living, breathing human beings who need to eat and sleep and go to the bathroom and bathe and all these things.
And they need money, which is a really big issue because Mary has no money at the beginning.
Yeah, and that was something else that was interesting to learn about the class structure, and especially with regard to what happens to a widow when her husband dies, and what happens to the daughter when the parent dies, and who gets what money, and where does it go? And she's basically destitute after the death of her mother in the beginning of the book.
Yeah. And also she's living through an economic depression. Right. So, you know, and she's in this very difficult position, which is that she's a lady. She's been trained to do nothing. She had a governess at one point. But her life has consisted of taking care of the household and taking care of her mother, who was very, very sick, who was mentally ill for a long time. And then she has no money. What does a lady do in those circumstances? Nobody wants to hire her for factory work.
Right. And she's certainly not going to become a woman of the night, and she's not going to stand on the street corner. But it goes to her, to the duality in her, because she knows that she needs to do something more with her life than what she's been doing. And maybe that's part of the Hyde in her, the Jekyll and Hyde aspect, that she's fighting with this idea of being a lady and doing what's proper. And at the same time, she's pulled in this direction of danger and murder and these sinister goings on in the background. And there's this one passage that I loved. It was on page 191, where they've just collected Catherine Moreau, and they're sneaking out of the tent, and they're dressing as men to blend in with the crowd. And she says, as she's dressing up, "It was a strange experience dressing as a man. Everything felt different, everything buttoned a different way. But when she had put on the shirt and trousers, she realized what freedom they would give her, how easily she could move. without petticoats swishing around her legs. No wonder men did not want women to wear bloomers. What could women accomplish if they did not have to continually mind their skirts, keep them from dragging in the mud or getting trampled on the steps of an omnibus? If they had pockets, with pockets, women could conquer the world. And I still hear that today, that women's clothing does not have pockets. And spoke so much to how she's finally coming to terms with her destiny in a way, that she is meant to do these things that only men had been trained and had been expected to do in this time period. And now it's part of her life as well.
Yeah. And the book, I mean, every book is a product of its time. My book is not a product of the 1890s. It's a product of now. And so it's in conversation with things that are going on. And so that conversation about pockets is one that I hear. I see it online. I see female friends of mine complaining that women's clothes still don't have pockets, and they don't. But part of that also comes out of my research, which isn't just online research or book research, although I do a lot of that, but trying to experience some of these things. So, for example, I've sewn the kind of skirt that Mary would be wearing. And I've put it on and felt what it would be like to walk with a bunch of petticoats that actually came from the time period. Petticoats survived pretty well. So all of this stuff, I try to pull from personal experience, having researched things about the late Victorian era. And the second book, which is coming out next summer, draws on my travels, in that it's, we already know the title, which I can tell you. Do you know what it is?
I do not, and I want to know right now, please.
Okay. It's called European Travel for the Monstrous Gentlewoman.
Oh, that's awesome.
And in it, the characters go to continental Europe. They go to the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And so I had to go to Vienna. Alas, the things we do for literature. but I walked around downtown Vienna, around the Ringstrasse, and mapped out all the different places where the action of the novel takes place, but really tried to pay attention to things like the texture of the road, trying to imagine what it would feel like to drive across the old cobblestones in a carriage, and mapping out how long it took to get from place to place, things like that. And then I did a bunch of research also in Budapest. So the action will take place in Vienna, primarily in Vienna and Budapest.
Wow. And you have all of this research, and you collect all of these facts and these characters, and there's so many Easter eggs in the book that, like you said, people aren't going to know every single one of them. And there's some really obscure text you've pulled and characters you've pulled, but how do you keep track of it all when you're writing a book like this?
That's a good question. How do I keep track of it? I mean, for the first book, I had a calendar. So when things happen relative to other things, and I did that for the second book as well, because the second book, it was quite complicated in terms of figuring out the timeline. The other things, though, I mean, I have a tab on my computer that gives me basic information, which is the sort of thing that I'm going to forget, like exchange rates or British money. You know, the difference between a guinea and a pound, things like that. And I'm sure I've made mistakes, because it's almost impossible not to make a mistake or a couple mistakes when you're trying to write about a time other than your own. And I have maps. There have been evenings when I've crawled around the floor looking at different maps, looking at a map of modern London superimposed on or right next to a map of London from the late 1800s. I have a Baedeker for things like exchange rates, foreign currency. But I think that the really important thing is for hopefully someone maybe to think, oh yeah, I can recognize that a lot of research went into this book, but for it not to be obtrusive at any point. And so what I try to do is not really think about it unless I need it. And so I will make notes, but if it's not in my head, if it's not there, then I don't pull from it. Like,
right. If it doesn't feel like common knowledge, if it doesn't feel like something you would just know in the moment, then it's probably not pertinent to the story, because you don't want it to sound like a textbook.
Exactly. And I don't want to be telling my character or telling my readers, you know, this is what it was like to live in late 19th century England, because that's not what the book's about. So the things I'm describing are really, I mean, they're in my head, partly because I've experienced them. Like, I've been to Lincoln's Inn Field, I've been to the Royal Society of Surgeons, and a lot of it is just me remembering what the buildings looked like, what the streets felt like. And it's been a while since I've been there, so at this point I've forgotten a little bit, but I'm really drawing on this stuff. I try to fill my head with this stuff as though I lived in the time period. And then I think about what I would experience if I were there. So I try not to have like documents filled with all sorts of facts, other than very simple things that I would forget, like street names and currency, stuff like that.
Right. I say this as a compliment. You don't provide a lot of context for things, and it feels good as I'm reading it, because it doesn't feel like I'm being told all of this stuff to prepare me for the story ahead, that I'm being given all of this context to study before I jump into this world. You just sort of throw us into this world, and we live in it for these 400 pages. And it never feels overwhelming. It never feels like I need to go look it up and really find out what's going on here, in terms of currency exchange rates or the societal expectations of the time. We just sort of live in this period in England with these characters, and that's what it is. So I think you do it in a really organic and well-structured way.
Good. Thank you. I'm glad, which is good, because I am name checking things that are not going to be familiar to people. Right. Like the debates over Darwinian evolution, things like that. A lot of that right. stuff, you know, you wouldn't necessarily know about nowadays unless you'd done a PhD dissertation on this period. But it's the stuff that the characters know.
Right. And a lot of that stuff isn't pertinent to the enjoyment of the story. I don't need to know all about Darwinian evolution to understand what these men were striving for when they were experimenting on their daughters. I know enough to enjoy the story and grasp what's going on in the book.
Good. Thank you.
You're a podcaster and blogger. You need an analytics and hosting platform that provides you with the right tools to make your job easier, so you can get back to doing what you do best, creating stuff. FeedPress is a delightfully intuitive RSS analytics and podcast hosting platform with accurate analytics for RSS feeds and email newsletters. Vloggers and podcasters can tap into RSS subscriber, geolocation, podcast download, and link tracking metrics, which come standard on all plans. In a matter of minutes, podcasters can create a feed and publish it to iTunes. Add your show notes, artwork, and drag and drop an MP3 into the editor to go live. Every podcast plan comes with 400 megabytes of file storage that's unmetered. This means you won't have to worry about running out of storage for long episodes or getting dinged for a sudden spike in download traffic when your podcast becomes an overnight success. FeedPress offers an automatic feed burner migration tool, so you can make that transition with ease. Your feeds and subscriber data will be moved into your FeedPress account. And if you're currently hosting a podcast elsewhere, they can help you migrate your feeds and media files over so that your listeners don't notice you've changed anything. Support is responsive and available 7 days a week via email. Sign up today and try FeedPress on a 14-day commitment-free trial. Use promo code COVERED during checkout to get 10% off your first year.
I know I read a little bit before, but I'd love to hear you read a section from the book, if you don't mind.
I do not mind. So I picked out a section when you asked me to read, and it's about 2 pages. It is from chapter four. It's from chapter four, which is called A Murder in Whitechapel. And it is when Mary has already found her supposed sister, Diana, and they have learned that yet another woman has been killed, because as the action of the book is going on, there are also these murders. And Sherlock Holmes has been called in to solve these murders. There are murders in Whitechapel. And what's happened is that all of these women that have been murdered have a different body part missing. So what I'm doing is it's sort of alternative history, but it's also alternative literary history, in that I'm taking the Whitechapel murders, except I'm messing around with them. I'm making them quite different from what they were in real life.
I also love that the title is very reminiscent of a Holmes story, A Murder in Whitechapel.
Good. I'm glad. Well, you know, The Strange Case of the Alchemist's Daughter it's supposed to be obviously a reference to The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, but it's also supposed to remind you of the casebook of Sherlock Holmes and the cases that he solves, that sort of thing. So if you hear a slight noise in the background, my cat just wandered in.
And so, I was wondering what that was.
Yeah, sorry about that.
That's fine.
She's a true writer's cat. Her name is Cordelia, and she inspires me and prevents me from writing.
Excellent. As a cat should.
As a cat should. Okay, so Mary and Diana and Dr. Watson have just appeared on this murder scene, and Holmes is already there. He's there with Lestrade. Now, I have to apologize. I'm not even going to try English accents. There is an audiobook of the novel. It is read by an amazing English actress, and she does all the stuff, and I can't. Holmes, I don't know what you're doing bringing a woman and a child to a murder scene, said the red-haired man. Watson can make himself useful, although nowadays he seems to spend his time recording your exploits rather than examining bodies. But they have no business being here. I'm not a child, said Diana. And who do you think you are, Carrots? Carrots yourself, said the red-haired man, glaring at her. This is Inspector Lestrade of Scotland Yard, said Holmes. He's not in the habit of locking up young women for rudeness, but it's probably a good idea not to tempt him. Lestrade, this is Miss Jekyll, the daughter of Dr. Jekyll, who was involved in the Carew murder case. You may remember it, although it was many years ago. She's here on business with me. But I'm afraid, Miss Jekyll, that this murder takes precedence. It was reported an hour ago. A man who does odd jobs in these parts found the body of a woman named Molly Keene lying in this alley. I have not yet examined the body myself and must do so at some length. As you are here, you and Miss Hyde may stay, but you may wish to avert your eyes. It's not a sight for the squeamish, I'm afraid. Mary stood undecided, afraid to see what lay under the sheet. Her head isn't missing, is it? She asked. That was the last victim, said Lestrade. He never takes the same body part twice, and if you look carefully, you'll see the outline of her head, or most of it. But Holmes, I protest, this is highly irregular. Holmes paid no attention, but lifted the sheet and handed it to one of the sergeants, who folded it gingerly, trying not to get blood on his uniform. Mary gasped. Horrible, said Watson. Lord, he'd done her in good, said Diana. Molly Keene had been around Mary's age. She must have been a pretty girl. The bones of her face were strong and fine, although the face itself was bruised. There were blue marks under the cheeks and under the eyes. Those eyes looked up at the gray sky, lifeless. There was blood spattered over her shoulders and soaked into her dress. Since the pavement was still wet from the morning's rains, the paving stones around her were slick and red, with blood pooling in the spaces between them. Her long hair trailed in the blood on the pavement. Mary forced herself to look back up to what she had been avoiding, the head lying in a pool of blood. The entire top of it, above the eyebrows, was gone. He cut out her brains, said Holmes. What could he possibly want with it? Asked Mary. He must be a madman, said Lestrade. Who else would do something like that? Molly Keene was a Well, I'm not going to say anything in front of the ladies. You shouldn't even be here, neither of you. A whore, said Diana. We know. Look at the rouge on her cheeks. But not an ordinary one, said Holmes. Look at her hands. Her palms were not calloused by manual labor, and her clothes are of good quality, although patched and mended. However she may have fallen, she was once a lady. You're right about that, said Lestrade. While we were waiting for you, Sergeant Debenham talked to one of the other girls who works this area. He's got her waiting at an inn around the corner. He's also holding the man who found the body, a local beggar who goes by Poor Richard and hasn't any other name, so far as I can tell. You'll want to talk to them, Holmes. According to her friend, Molly Keene had been a governess until she was seduced by her master and thrown out by her mistress. Her child died at birth, and she went on the streets to earn her living. A sad story, and not an uncommon one, said Watson, shaking his head. Poor girl, said Mary. She had read about this side of London life, but never encountered it herself. It shocked her, although not as much as it should have. This was life, wasn't it? Life as she had often imagined it, looking out the curtained windows of the house on Park Terrace.
Excellent. I love Diana. She might be my favorite character in the book.
I love Diana. I think Diana is great. She is incorrigible. I can tell you that she will never behave. That's not going to happen.
It's great. And especially in her asides, in the portions of the book where she's talking about the manuscript, especially the way she talks to Mrs. Poole and just doesn't take any of her guff. It's so funny.
Good. Well, I'm glad you like her.
I did want to talk to you because one of the big themes throughout the book is turning the idea of the father slash husband as protector on its head, and the, you know, these women are experimented on by their fathers. We learned that through the letters they exchange with each other that they basically bred girls. They wanted girls just so that they could experiment on them. As opposed to men who would be brought up as apprentices and students to learn their ways and to learn their scientific methods. So I'm wondering, had this always been there, or was this something that you had sort of pulled out and worked for the story? Because it is fascinating to learn, especially with Rappaccini, which is, that is the story, that he exposes his daughter to these plants and she becomes poisonous. But, you know, the Jekyll part of it and the Frankenstein portion of it, where he builds her and then dismantles her. Had that whole idea of the father as experimenter on the daughter always been there?
It's there in the literature, interestingly enough. Rappaccini's daughter, of all the figures in this book, probably Beatrice will be the one that people aren't familiar with, because it is kind of an obscure Hawthorne story, although I think it's one of Hawthorne's best stories. But the original Rappaccini's daughter is about Dr. Rappaccini bringing up his daughter to be poisonous so that she can tend his poisonous plants. He uses them to make medicines, things like that. So that's in Hawthorne. You have the same thing happening in The Great God Pan, where you have a Dr. Raymond who has a daughter. She is, at least the implication in the text is that she is literally his daughter. And then you've got Dr. Moreau, who's creating the Beast Woman. So it's there in the text. And the question is why? And I sort of brought in this idea that experimenting on young women, first, it's easier, right? They're less likely to resist you.
Right.
It fits in with kind of Victorian ideas that their brains would be more malleable. They would be, in a sense, easier to work with. And there's a sense in which they're kind of disposable in a way that young men were not in the Victorian era. In the Victorian era, if you wanted someone to work in your factory and you wanted them to be nimble and quick and willing and obedient and quiet, maybe not agitating for labor rights, if you wanted them to have small hands, you would hire women or you would hire children. So these are, in a sense, the ones in the Victorian era that don't have the power to fight back.
And in a sick and twisted way, it's almost feminist that these, yes, what the fathers did to their daughters was horrible, but at the same time, Rappaccini's daughter, Beatrice, can protect herself. She doesn't need him to protect her, as the father is often expected to do. And the same goes for Catherine. You know, she is part cat. She can protect herself from whoever is attacking them. So, and Justine, you know, she's got this super strength. She's a Frankenstein's monster. So,
right.
You know, in a way they're bred to be experimented on. And at the same time, they are bred to defend themselves.
And funnily enough, that comes from the literature as well, in that it's one of the rationales that Dr. Rappaccini gives for creating his daughter. He says to her, "You are stronger than most women. Look at how wonderful you are." When at the end she says, "Father, what have you done to me?" And he's justifying himself in that way, saying, "Daughter, I have made you stronger." Which is ironic, because it doesn't end well for Rappaccini's daughter in the original story, which is one of the reasons I wanted to rewrite it, because all of these monsters die in the original stories. And I didn't want any of them to die. I wanted them mm-hmm. all to be alive and to be talking and having adventures and doing things. But yeah, it's, I consider this a feminist text, and some of that appears in the original, some of it. Even the fact that Justine, well, she's not Justine in the original Frankenstein, but that Frankenstein destroys her because she would be too strong. She would outcompete human beings.
It's funny, because the image of Frankenstein, and I think a lot of people have, is the Karloff version, where he doesn't say anything. He just grunts the entire movie. And the movie is so much different from the book, but mm-hmm. it really is worth going back to the book and reading the original text, because there's so much to unpack in there that they just are not able to capture on film.
Yeah, the book is absolutely brilliant, and you don't have Dr. Frankenstein in the book. The way I tell it to my students when I teach it is that Frankenstein, basically, he's like a college freshman. You know, doing lab work on his own, essentially, and working on these ideas that he's been introduced to by his biology and chemistry professors. I mean, that's what really happens in the book. He's not the great Dr. Frankenstein. He's a college student.
It's funny to think what, you know, he would have been doing this time period, you know, drinking heavily and joining a frat, but now he's tearing up, putting together bodies and bringing them to life.
Well, you never know, because you've got like Steve Jobs creating Apple, right? He could have been creating AI. He could have been one of those guys in a black turtleneck, you know, trying to create some sort of tech company. Who knows?
It's true. And we see that in a lot of modern retellings of these stories, that, you know, Ex Machina, about the artificial, the robot girl they build, who, you know, is sort of seducing these men who created her. And then the movie Her, which was just heartbreaking, but this artificial intelligence that gains sentience, you know, these stories are still coming around and around and around. They never really die.
They don't die, and they are reconfigured so that the new monster that we're dealing with right now is the cyborg. And I talk to my students about things like their relationships with their cell phones and the way in which they have integrated electronic components into their lives. We are, all of us, functionally, in a sense, cyborgs now. And that can make us very uncomfortable.
Yeah, there was a there's the new iPhone is out, and there's an ad. If you watch video on the internet, there's an advertisement, and the song they use to sell the ad has the line, "Every time you call on me, I drop what I do. You are my best friend, and we've got some things to do." I mean, that
about the phone?
It's talking about the phone. Every time you call on me, I drop what I do. So every time it rings or gives me a notification, I drop everything to check it. And you are my best friend, and we've got some things to do. I mean, that just, it's squeamish. Like, it's just really creepy to think of my cell phone as my best friend. And it's one reason I had Carolyn Porter, who wrote the book Marcel's Letters, on my last episode. And it's all about her developing a font based on this man's handwriting. And we'd gotten into a discussion about handwriting and writing letters. And she sent me this wonderful little postcard with this beautiful handwriting of hers after the show. And I have a typewriter, and I've been typing letters to friends and things. And it's to unplug and walk away and get away from all of that, because where technology is headed with Alexa, which I have an Echo, and I've got Siri, and I've got all of those things.
You've got all the things I don't have.
Yeah, it's, you know, they're useful to walk into a room and say, hey, turn on the lights. It's fun and everything. But then you think, oh, this thing's always listening. This thing is learning about me. It's selling me things. It hears every fight I have with my spouse and every time I talk to my child about something. And it's picking all of that up, and then it's going to spit it back at me at some point, or someone's going to hack into it and use it against me. You know, it really makes you want to live in a cabin surrounded by trees with nary a neighbor in sight.
Yeah. And the other thing is that it takes resistance out of your life. Resistance is the sort of the, if you think about it in terms of the resistance that the world offers us as we are embodied, switching on a light bulb offers some resistance to you. You have to work at switching on mm-hmm. that light bulb, turning a television channel. Remember television way back when? All of these things, the world offers resistance to us, and saying, turn on the light, there's no resistance there. So it's very attractive to live this kind of seamless existence. It's almost a magical existence. It feels like we're living in fantasy because we have these magical instruments that we don't actually understand, most of us, and they do things for us when we say magical words. So it's very seamless to live in that world, and yet we lose something when we don't feel the world pushing back against us.
It's very creepy when my son walks into the bathroom where we don't have an Echo Dot or anything, and he says, Alexa, turn on the lights. And then I feel like Frankenstein looking at his creation going, what have I done?
Yeah, it's interesting for me because I teach at a university, and so I have a new class of freshmen every year. They come in, and the freshmen that I have now don't remember a world before the internet. They don't remember a world in which you had to roll up your car window. Mm-hmm. And I still
have to.
Do you really?
I do. I drive a Toyota Yaris. It is basically a golf cart with doors, and I have to roll up and down the window every time.
There's that resistance, right? The world is offering you resistance. But yeah, I remember a world in which phones were connected to the wall. And in which you still watched, I mean, I don't even have a television anymore. I watch stuff on my phone or on my computer. Mm-hmm. But I was doing some research in the archives of Ursula Gwynn at the beginning of last summer for another project. And there are typewritten letters between, for example, Ursula Gwynn and Philip K. Dick or Stanislaw Lem. And it's very interesting to see how much personality those typewritten letters have. And it has to do with the imprint of the letter on the page. It was pushed down by somebody's finger that caused a reaction, and every machine is different. There's so much personality in those letters. And as soon as you get to the era of email, all of that is lost. All you have is a printout, and it actually changes the quality of the communication. The communication becomes much less personal. The voice is different. So the ways in which we write things changes what it is that we write, I think. It's terribly old-fashioned, but I write fiction by hand. First.
I'm doing that right now for NaNoWriMo.
Are you? Yeah.
I am. I'm doing it all by hand.
Yeah. It leads to a tired hand. Mm-hmm. But I think my ideas flow better when I write by hand.
Absolutely. And to be able to write without something notifying me in the corner of my screen, or to be drawn in by Facebook or Wikipedia or anything like that, to just be able to write. And I've done it before. I wrote one book by hand entirely, and I'm doing it again this time because I need to unplug for a little while. It is so freeing to be able to do something like that. And I think back to, there's a documentary on HBO, Six by Sondheim, and Stephen Sondheim talks about his process for writing a musical. And he says, I love working with pencil, specifically Blackwing pencils, but he loves how soft they are. And what he loves the most is that he has to sharpen. He says sharpening for me allows me to, you know, take a break, to take a few seconds or a few minutes to just sort of think and take a step back from the manuscript or the composition and look at it in a different light and then go back to it. You know, that little pause between sharpening your pencil and going back to the page is kind of a magical thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's nice to slow down. There's a value in slowing down rather than just trying to get the words up on the screen.
Right.
Which actually I think is part of our fascination with the era, to bring it back to that issue. This is before World War One, right? And World War One changed our world in fundamental ways. So it's just at the beginning of the technological transformation that leads to us. And it is, it depends on how you count, but it can be early modernism. It can just be just before the beginning of modernism. It's just before a lot of things were broken and in the process of that breaking.
Right. It's before serial killer profiling. It's before DNA tests. It's before fingerprint analysis, all of that.
And yet it's when things change. It's like somewhere between Art Nouveau and Art Deco. Mm-hmm. Right, which is a really important transitional period.
So I have to ask, the sequels, are they also told in the same style where one of them, Catherine, is writing the story and they're talking throughout it?
Yes. It comes out, I think, sounding a little bit different because the relationship between the girls develops over time. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I did keep that stylistic quirk, I guess. The one difference is that in the first book, they're learning about each other. So they're each telling their stories. There's a lot of backstory that comes in. In the second one, there's a lot less backstory. So it's a lot more narrative, and they're still interrupting the narrative to comment on it. But there's a lot less going back into the past and talking about what happened to them and what made them what they were. It's more, propulsive in a way.
Awesome. I can't wait for it to come out. I'm very excited. And you said summer 2018?
Summer 2018. And then, the Saga Press, my wonderful editor, Novel Wolf, who's amazing, contacted me and my agent really just this fall after I turned in the third book. And we had talked about the fact that, there was going to be a third book. So right after I turned in the second book, she contacted me and she said, okay, let's do the contract for the third book because we know we want to do a third book. And I said, yeah. And the third book completes the arc. So it is going to be a three book series.
Excellent. Theodora, thank you so much for coming on. This is wonderful.
Thank you. It's been so much fun.
Where can people find you online?
Oh my gosh. I'm kind of everywhere. You can just Google me, Theodora Goss. My website is theodoragoss.com. I'm on Facebook, I'm on Twitter, and I'm on Instagram.
We'll put links to everything in the show notes. This has been Covered with special guest Theodora Goss. Links to The Strange Case of the Alchemist's Daughter and all other titles discussed will be available in our show notes and on our website at hologramradio.org/covered. I'd like to thank our Patreon patrons Brad Dowdy, Vaughn Johnson, Chris Jones, Tim Wassum, Stuart Lennon, Kyle Wallace, Alex Knight, and Aaron Mankey. If you're able to give a dollar or two an episode to help fund more great interviews like this one today, please consider supporting Covered at patreon.com/covered. In addition to helping me make the show, you'll also gain access to ad-free versions of these episodes, as well as a bonus mini-episode at the $5 level. And if you fancy other Hologram Radio shows and would like to drop a few dollars their way, you can support the network as a whole at patreon.com/hologramradio. You can also follow me on Twitter at HCMarks and the show at Covered_FM. Thank you to TJ Cosgrove for a beautiful logo and Lorenzo Gudemi for all the hard work he puts into making this show sound fantastic. And as always, thank you again to FeedPress and Noct Sound Engineering for their support of this show. And remember, don't judge a book till it's covered.